the reason these disturbances, they followed you to a new home, is because it's not the house that's haunted. It's your son.
So 1,100 men went in the war. 316 men come out. The Sharks took the rest June the 29th, 1945. Anyway, we delivered the bomb.
Never, ever, ever, under any circumstances, say, I'll be right back. Because you won't be back.
You get another beer, you want one?
Yeah, sure.
I'll be right back!
I have come here to chew bubblegum and kick ass. And I'm all out of bubblegum.
Oh, shit.
My name is Robert Hawkins. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. You found this. If you're watching this, then you know more about it than I do.
California, stay away from me. Stay away from me. I'll come in here. John Doe has the upper hand.
And on that day, Ahab will go to his grave, but he'll rise again within the hour. He will rise and beckon that all save one shall follow.
They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you! They're all gonna laugh at you!
Hello. Welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. We are going straight into the movie due to some technical issues prior, but there are five co-hosts of us, and let's just do those. I'm Phil from New Hampshire. Eric?
This is Eric in Michigan.
Mike?
This is Mike from New York.
And Abe?
Hi, everyone. This is Abram from Massachusetts.
And Christy?
And this is the world's most famous Connecticut American, Chrissy.
There we go, there we go. All right, so Eric, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight we are going to be discussing the latest movie from director-writer Ari Aster called Midsommar.
I told you that I want to go to that festival in Sweden.
No, you said it would be cool to go.
Yeah, and then I got the opportunity and I decided
Look,
to do it.
I don't mind you going, I just wish you would have told me, that's all.
Dude, she needs a therapist. You've been wanting out of this stupid relationship for, like, a year now.
And don't forget about all of the beautiful Swedish women you'll meet in June.
Okay, guys.
That's not her again. Seriously?
Babe, what's happening? Danny.
I was so very sorry to hear about what happened.
I'm sorry.
I invited Danny to come to Sweden.
You know what she's been going through.
Christian says you've got this special week planned.
It's sort of a crazy festival. Special ceremonies and dressing up.
That sounds fun.
Unbelievable.
Welcome and happy midsummer. Skål!
What time is it?
9 p.m.
That can't be right. The sky is blue.
This is what 9 p.m. is like here.
How long have you two been together?
Just over 3.5 years.
4 years.
Really?
Yeah.
What do you think?
It's like another world.
Tomorrow's a big day.
Is it scary?
What is it?
It has special properties. What am I going through?
We just need to acclimate.
I don't want to acclimate. I want to go.
Absolutely not.
What's happening?
I don't know why you've invited us.
That's why you look so guilty right now, because you know.
We only do this every 90 years. I was most excited for you to come.
That's right. Midsommar is a 2019 film. It's the sophomore effort from that director. He also is the writer of the script. The film is a film that stars a number of people. No one of real note, that meaning, you know, they're not famous or anything to our knowledge, but the names are Florence Pugh, Jack Rayner, William Jackson Harper, Wilhelm Blumgren, and the person that's probably the most popular actor of the bunch is Will Poulter, who actually, the last film I saw him in was Detroit, where he played a villainous cop. Yeah, he was pretty good in that film. And I know you saw that too, Eric.
Yeah, good movie.
Yeah. So the film is a co-produced Swedish and American co-production. It's an A24 film, which have been fairly polarizing to fan bases, though not necessarily critics. This is actually our second A24 film of the year that we're reviewing. The prior one was The Hole in the Ground, an Irish film. Most of the actors in this film are European actors. I believe Jack Rayner is an Irish and American joint citizenship, and William Jackson Harper, he is English. Florence Pugh, I believe, is English, and so forth and so on. So mostly foreign actors, and basically the supporting cast is all generally foreign as well, mostly, I think, Swedish folk.
They're all Swedes.
They're all Swedes. In this case, almost everyone is.
I don't remember exactly how I first heard about this, but it's been kicking around the internet for a while because Ari Aster got so much attention for Hereditary last year. So I was definitely interested in checking it out. I was trying to keep my expectations in check because I enjoyed Hereditary so much. And I tried to avoid knowing anything specifically about it until I got to the theater, which was rather difficult. But I did and went, and I enjoyed it. Probably not quite as much as Hereditary, but I enjoyed it quite a bit. And I can't wait to talk about it.
All right, very good. Abe?
Well, this is a film that kind of popped up on the radar earlier, especially since I had liked most of Hereditary. It has some issues with it, but overall, it was an enjoyable film, and, you know, when I saw this, I was curious. I saw last week, prior to this recording, and my feelings towards it are mixed. There's some great imagery, there's some really solid acting. It's a very slow burn, though, and the runtime felt a little excessive in certain places. It kind of dragged on. There are moments where I thought some things were more silly than unsettling, and there are moments where it kind of fell where just like Hereditary did in terms of obvious plot pathway. Overall, it's still a solid looking film. It's got great presentation, and it's got some interesting shots. It's a very different film. It's one thing I definitely say is that you're not going to see too many films with this kind of unsettling oddness. Yeah, it's a curiosity, and for me, overall, it was a series of ups and downs.
All right, very good. I obviously heard about it because a lot of talk was because of who was directing the film. This would be the sophomore effort of Mr. Aster, so it was getting good press, at least in independent cinema and horror fans, and even the critics, they were talking about it as a film to look out for. Didn't know too much about it, though. I didn't see the trailers at all. I didn't read any blurbs at all. And so I honestly went in completely blind with no idea at all what the film was going to be about. The only couple of things I heard was that someone wrote on Facebook that it was kind of a comedy. So I thought it was going to have some humorous elements, but it really just not at all. So I don't know where that came from. And I did hear someone also state that it felt similar to The Wicker Man, the classic, not the Nicolas Cage Bees film. And yeah, I could see that as well. Abe mentioned that it was felt like a slower film. It was 2 hours and 30 or 40 minutes, so it is a longer film. And I was okay with that. I was fairly engrossed with what was going on in the cinema. I did not get really bored at all. At the beginning, I was not too happy. I thought this movie was going to be pretty bad because it felt pretentious, and the main characters were, at least the girl, someone that I didn't really like at first. And again, I didn't really necessarily like her at all by the end of the film either, but as the movie went along, it was a little better. I have to say I really liked this film. I thought it was very solid. I liked it a lot more than Hereditary. There is some people that will have some issues with it. I mean, it is pretentious at various points, interesting camera angles and things that as a younger director would do didn't seem necessary, but I'd say someone like Scorsese, he probably wouldn't have done it. And the story was fairly telegraphed. You kind of gathered and knew what was going to happen. And also some of the characters stuck with where they went longer than I would have. But again, these characters weren't necessarily characters that were people that most of us could identify with, probably. But all in all, I felt this was a fantastic film and possibly the best horror film of the year. It's going to be tough to beat it, I think, and I could not be surprised to see it as my number one horror film of the year at the end, depending on what comes next. But a high, high recommend by me. Mike?
Yeah. My wife and I went to see this, I think a couple of days, I think it was the Sunday after it came out. I was a huge fan of Hereditary. This is definitely a white people are crazy horror film. It's kind of a backwoods horror film, except it's in Europe, so it's more polite than you would get if you were in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Yeah, I understand why people are saying there's a comedy aspect to it. I don't think they understand that it's not a comedy. There's stuff in it that's very uncomfortable, and people laugh at things when they get uncomfortable. And so people were laughing at things that weren't necessarily, that were just odd more than funny. It's not trying to be funny, but it's people aren't laughing at it because it's badly done either. My problem with the film is that it's not hard to see where it's going throughout most of its runtime. I think it shoots its load a little too early in the film. For a 2.5-hour film, that's a bit of a problem. But at the same time, I was pretty much engrossed throughout most of the film. It is a beautifully shot film. Very well, in that regard, it's. I know they're releasing a director's cut, which is another 30 minutes. I think one of the things I said after it is that I either would have liked to see them tighten up the runtime or flesh out the story more. I don't know. I'm hoping that means they're freshening out the story and just not adding more sustained tracking shots of people in flowers. But yeah, I think it's a decent movie. I would rate it as one of the better movies I've seen this year, probably. Last time I talked to my wife, she still didn't know what she thought of the film. So yeah, it's just a little. It's an odd film. It's not going to be for everybody. It's not a crowd pleaser type necessarily, but I can see, it seems to me the audience that I was with enjoyed it more or is less divided on it than the Hereditary audience was. But they also weren't necessarily as into it at certain points. So yeah, I like it. At the same time, I think it's got some issues that I think they could have fixed a little bit. And we'll talk about that in the upcoming hour or so.
All right. Very good. Chrissy.
Yeah, I'm with Eric. I enjoyed it. And I'm also with Abe. It's a very unique film. I heard about it from somebody posting on the Facebook group. This is the second Ari Aster film I've seen. And the first, of course, was Hereditary. I've now determined that every time I see one of his films, I'm going to have to come home and do a shot of whiskey. I seem to feel... After both of these films, I felt, and I finally identified it this time, it is exactly the same gamut of emotions that I felt after each of my parents passed away. it really messed with me emotionally, which is nice for me because I think this director just kind of goes with my vibe. To me, this is true horror. This was emotional. Yes, the situation is outlandish in both films, but if you've experienced any kind of true, deep, life-altering trauma, then you get this film, and you get this film in horrifying ways that you wish you didn't. You wish you didn't get. This film is not for the faint of heart. I'm not going to say it's the best thing I've seen all year because the emotional impact messed with me so much that I just really can't make a judgment call. I'm actually still kind of undecided. I loved Hereditary because it messed with me so much, but this time I'm kind of like, oh God, I don't know if I want to do this to myself again. Yeah, I really don't. But I mean, but it's weird because that's almost a positive. You know, you want to go to a movie and have it affect you in a way that, like, oh my God, like, that is a great film. So I do believe it's a good film. I do agree with Mike. It's got a couple of problems. I'm interested to see if we match up. And, you know, again, with the funny comments, Eric had told me, no, it was nervous laughter. And that was definitely certainly the case here. I was with an audience that was just giggling at everything, and I wasn't giggling at all because I was freaking traumatized. So I was like, oh my God, why are they all laughing? But it's true, it's because it's uncomfortable. Some of the things that are in there are just very odd, really unsettling images, and some of them go toward places of taboo, and that's why people were laughing, because when you get into an area of taboo, people don't really know what to do with that. I thought the acting was really good. I thought the script was pretty tight, except for a few small problems I had. I thought the setting of the world of this culture was really pretty immersive and very well developed. When you're creating a culture that doesn't exist, I think it's really tough to get it to feel realistic. And I thought that this, for the most part, did feel realistic. I was concerned that because of the length of the movie, it was going to drag. Unlike Abe, I didn't feel that it dragged. I was pretty much sucked in the whole time. And it kind of flew by for me. I was like, oh my, I didn't even check my phone once. And that's unusual because sometimes I check the time. I also thought that some of the characters were pretty well developed, the two main ones anyway, Danny and Christian. And I thought overall that in some situations, these characters actually did act very realistically. I did believe that they could be real people. And that goes a long way with me. Even if some of these characters were a little bit over the top, like particularly Danny because of her damage and her issues. The sad thing is I know people that are like her, and they really are like that. So I think it's that to me was the most stunning point of it. I was like, wow, I actually know people like that. And that's exactly how they would behave. Anyway, that's my thoughts on it. I'm anxious to get into the conversation.
All right. Sounds good. So, Eric, do we have what we call Wiki.
A couple travels to Sweden to visit a rural hometown's fabled midsummer festival. What begins as an idyllic retreat quickly devolves into an increasingly violent and bizarre competition at the hands of a pagan cult.
Yeah, all right. That sounds about right, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So, before we throw up the spoiler and all that, I'm just curious about discussing general stuff. What do we got?
One thing I noticed right away is that this film does a lot of foreshadowing.
Yes.
For example, there's background imagery. It's like pictures, paintings, tapestry. carvings that foreshadow.
I wanted my Liopleurodon.
some things were a little more subtle than others. I noticed some things were like, obviously, as Mike said, obviously telegraphed.
It's a love story.
And, well, it's a breakup movie. It's a breakup story. And a hell of a breakup story. But one thing is that some things are like little pieces that you had to kind of put together yourself. And other things are a little more, is like almost like the foretelling of upcoming events. One thing which we'll discuss is like the love potion thing. or the hair pie, whatever you want to call it, and the bear and stuff like that. It's risky to try things like that because it, sometimes it does kind of inadvertently take away some of the surprise. And other things to kind of leave you guessing because the one thing, as I mentioned, was the bear. I wasn't certain what the bear's purpose was going to be, but there were things like, as I said, the tapestry of the potion, which were obviously going to happen.
Well, and I think it's interesting that both you and Phil and maybe Mike as well, I'll mention that as a negative that it was telegraphed. And I kind of enjoyed that. I liked the fact that they set it up and then they knocked it down. Let me finish. Okay. If they didn't give you the setup, like with that tapestry, for instance, we won't talk about it in detail until spoilers. But if they didn't give you the tapestry as a setup, later on, you'd be really confused as to exactly what the hell is going on. So I kind of enjoyed the fact that they set it up at the beginning.
Yeah,
I do agree with you, Eric. I do. That was one of my comments too.
I say it was just hit and miss for me. Some things were a little more, I thought, just a little more cleverly put out there on the wall. Like, for example, in the apartment room, there's actually a picture of a girl with a bear. And it kind of repeats itself with the burning bear image and stuff like that. And, of course, seeing the bear in the cage, like a three beat.
That's Chrissy's line.
I was going to say, you're not allowed to say that.
Oh, he can steal it from me tonight. Good job, Abe. Good job.
You know, so I like things like that where you can kind of pick up things and just kind of see the, it was not really saying so much a bad thing, but it was also just kind of like, okay, where is this going to come up? You know, like, I don't know. It maybe it was because it felt so obvious that it was going to occur in the plot. I don't know. It was just, that part was just a little bit of a big bag for me.
Fair enough.
It's not about a matter of things like foreshadowing stuff like the tapestry, which, you know, has helped to catch people up on that. It's things like, I mean, if you know something about old medieval rituals, then the tapestry stuff isn't necessarily that necessary, but yeah, it should be there. It's just the fact that there are films that have, a film should have a twist or a turn in there somewhere, not necessarily a M. Night Shyamalan big twist surprise, but have some unexpected events occur somewhere, and everything kind of plays out, you know, as I would have expected. Figured out what they were doing, why they were doing it.
In generalities, yes, I agree with you. I think there's some specific details that were a little surprised.
Well,
we'll get to it in spoilers.
Maybe certain specific details, sure. But for a film that takes its time getting to where it's going, you know, there really is nothing. Like I said, it's visually beautiful to watch, but there's also, I don't know, that fun. It could have been more, maybe more gripping or more riveting along the way instead of just, okay, that's weird. I guess that's stuff that could have gotten me more emotionally involved instead of intellectually involved.
Okay. And the humor came up a few different times when we were discussing our initial thoughts. I think there were a few moments of humor and they were totally done intentionally in this movie. I can think of at least three different moments during the movie where my audience burst out laughing as one. So I think they were intentional. I think they were effective, and I think they were meant as a release as to all the building dread that's going on in the movie. So I don't think it's a comedy. I think people who are saying it's a comedy are mistaken. But I do think there's an intentional element of humor in the movie.
I think there's also some not just comic relief, but there's also some dark humor in there as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I think the problem maybe is that some people have trouble differentiating what is the dark humor and what is supposed to be unsettling, and that could be some kind of a tonal confusion there.
Right, right. And I do also agree. I think it was Chrissy that was saying that there is some nervous laughter. There's definitely a lot of nervous laughter in the theater when I was watching this. There was a couple of guys sitting next to me who were definitely having a nervous giggle reaction to the movie.
Right. Well, there's the pie. There's the glass of lemonade. There's the sex scene. Uh-huh. These are all things that are intended to make you go, oh, my God, no. You know, God, that's gross. That's uncomfortable. You know, but there are people who legitimately are thinking this is a comedy and not a horror film. And this is that.
Yeah, I don't understand that take myself. Yeah. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, I mean, for me, there were some moments where I know they were trying to be unsettling, but there were moments where I just kind of thought it was kind of silly looking and stuff like that. Well, other moments, they were kind of successful. Like the payoff of the bear was kind of shocking, but I thought it was kind of, maybe because I remember the Wicker Man, Nicolas Cage movie, that I just pictured when it's that character in the bear skin.
Oh.
I just pictured Nicolas Cage there instead.
Well, that's your fault for watching that awful movie.
Well, no, it's all over the internet, too. I mean, you can't escape that. That movie was a meme. More than it was a movie.
So, anybody else want to discuss things in generality before we throw up spoiler flag?
Well, I'll wait until after the spoiler, because it's directly related to some of the characters. So I got.
I still wanted my play it on. Just that really...
What's that word?
What do you call that one? Chrissy, do you know what I'm talking about? There's a scene in the apartment early on, and if you look, mm-hmm. there's different pictures in the background, one of which is a picture of a girl facing off against a bear.
Bear, yep.
Another one, there's a picture of what looks like a princess or something surrounded by, I think it was a bunch of heads. But then there was like a primeval kind of thing of what looked like a pliosaur. It was like a dinosaur. I was waiting for a dinosaur. I wanted a dinosaur. Like you gave us a painting with a bear, then you gave us paintings with dinosaurs. I wanted my dinosaurs.
Okay,
I'm just saying.
That's the alert. That means we're going into spoiler territory.
I think so. So it's
but to answer your question, no, I had some trouble in this movie because it was so richly packed with stuff like that, like with the bear and the different. You know, stories and the different etchings and the drawings. And it was difficult to tell what were, and also I couldn't look at them long enough to really like get a good like feel for them. And that was part of one of the things I wanted to say about the culture is that I think what he may have done is not necessarily alluded to specific things, but sort of taken things that would make sense in the culture he created and kind of made them feel like they were alluding to something, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's a lot of little details.
Because I don't know of any stories about a princess surrounded by heads.
No, I mean, it might not have been so much about folklore and that with that image, but it might have been more of like a misleading thing, kind of leave you guessing what was actually foretelling something and what was just kind of misdirection.
Right, well, or what was in their culture.
Unless the heads are supposed to be the effigies at the end.
Well, and
that makes sense. Yeah.
From what I understand, this culture is completely fake, but Ari Aster did do a bunch of research into religions like this in Europe, and there are bits and pieces taken from those. So as a whole is completely fictional, but there are little pieces that are taken from reality. I'm hoping that the disc has a commentary because I'd be fascinated to listen to him talk about that.
Right. And I think things like the dinosaur hinting at, you know, this is a more primitive culture in terms of it's a like a pagan ritual. I think it's getting more to that, like the primeval nature.
Mm-hmm.
More than anything, it's not intended to be literal. However, we all know the movie would be better with dinosaurs in it.
Well, and I got to be honest, Mike, when I walked out of the theater, I was with Pam on this because I was like, did I like that? I'm not sure. I've certainly been thinking about the movie a lot, which means it at least triggered neurons in my brain, which is a good thing. And I enjoyed the experience while I was there. But it's unique to be sure. And I'm still, you know, I give it all credit for being a good movie. I'm hesitant to say I love it though. I appreciate it. And I yeah,
I think that's.
Like I'm in the same spot, Eric. I'm in the exact same spot.
Yeah, that's a good summary.
Yeah, that's where I'm at with it. And I think Phil may have liked it most out of all of us.
Yeah, I think you may be right. Yeah,
I surprised you. Sure. Now, Phil, I want you to explain a comment that you made to me about this movie.
Okay.
Which is that you said you went into it wanting to hate it, and I don't understand why you'd ever want to hate a movie.
Yeah, that's kind of a strange comment.
Because he hated Hereditary.
So, what's that got to do with anything?
Yeah, no, that's a good question. I think it was because I heard that it was a comedy and that it was a ripoff of The Wicker Man. Okay. And then of course the I was figuring that it was going to be very pretentious and mm-hmm. all these little hidden things, which are fine. Well, and that's great.
And that's in there. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like that opening shot where they have like the shot of the woods in the winter. Right. For no particular reason.
Yeah.
No, that is definitely pretentious.
Yeah. And
right. Well, an upside down car ride to the.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. There were a few of those things that honestly, you know, when I see something like that in a film, I try to assess if it maybe is a symbol for something. When I saw the snow and then the shrilling of the phone. Breaking the silence. I did enjoy that moment because I jumped out of my skin. I wasn't expecting it. And I thought it also might have been a symbol of the peace that has been established is about to be, you know, overturned. It's about to be disrupted, because this tragedy is coming. However, he didn't do anything else with snow. And then the car image being upside down kind of didn't really do anything except like, oh, the world is going to turn itself upside down. Okay. You know, that's kind of, what I'm saying here is I agree with you guys. I think those particular two images were just pretentious and they really didn't connect to anything. If the snow had showed up in significant places throughout, because they put so much stress on it.
Yeah, well,
now, if you're just going to open a scene and, oh, it's snowing and the phone rings, okay, that's fine. It doesn't have to snow through the whole movie. But here we're watching this snowscape in the woods, and there's so much stress put on this snowy landscape, and then it never comes back. So it's kind of like, all right, that was stupid. Like,
right, I'm wondering if perhaps that the snow was supposed to be like, if at the beginning where we have a tragic death. I mean, winter is usually the death of things, with the summer and spring being the rebirth.
Well, so, and they talk about that later when they get to the Swedish place.
Yeah, and I honestly think it might have helped it more if that snow imagery was done a little more around when we have the suicide.
Yes, that would have been a good place to put it.
Yeah. I mean,
yep.
Because otherwise, its placement so early was very views and I just felt very artsy fartsy.
Yeah,
well, a lot of this movie was artsy fartsy.
Well, yeah, but I mean, at least with other parts of it, there was a cohesiveness to the artsy fartsiness.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I think there's an interesting thing, not necessarily a good thing. I think they have it still winter when they left. Right. It's only a month since the suicide, and this is a midsummer ceremony.
Yes.
And that means it's taking place in July.
Well, yeah, there was a 6 month fast forward.
Was there? I didn't catch the 6 months.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I you're right, Mike. It didn't feel like there was a 6 months, but I read somewhere in a number of reviews, which I read after watching the film, that it was a 6 months fast forward. So if we all missed it, or you missed it, and I missed it. During the film, other people, I guess, did not miss that.
Right. I mean, I think a lot of it was.
I don't know if they had like a text over on the screen, but it certainly didn't confuse me.
Right.
Well, no, I was just wondering if, again, it was maybe it's the symbolism of the winter compared to the midsummer. Right. Okay. I think it's just there to serve as a contrast. I think the whole upside down car thing is just to show. Right, they're going into a whole new world. It's a transition. They're going from one world to the next, and that, you know, that's very much what he's doing there. So I don't think it was necessary. I didn't necessarily mind it, but I know I've seen that in other movies recently. So whereas I know I kind of liked that shot in a film we saw a year or two ago, now it just felt like I've seen this before and didn't feel original. I didn't bother me so much, but it just didn't impress me either. But it's but a lot of those flourishes do kind of disappear once you get to there. The play, you know, the
yeah. It's I think it's two different movies. There's the setup, and then once they get to the place, that it's a different world, for lack of a better term.
Right.
One thing I want to talk about that I really enjoyed about this movie is the boyfriend. First of all, his name is
Chris Pratt.
Yeah. First of all, his name is Christian. I'm sure Chris, you'll have something to say about that. And I also liked, I really enjoyed the fact that he's a real world asshole. You know, a lot of, in a lot of movies, the bad boyfriend will be really just overdrawn, and eyebrows waggling evil or just complete dick. This guy wasn't over the top dicky. He was certainly not a good guy. He was certainly tone deaf to his girlfriend's needs. Yeah, she probably should have broken up with him a long time ago. But on the surface, he wasn't like a horrible person. He's just not a great boyfriend. And I kind
Never
of enjoyed
her, anyway.
That. Right. And I kind of enjoyed that about the movie, is that he wasn't just, from hell evil. He's just a dude, and this wasn't working out.
Yeah, one thing right. I think about in terms of how, you know, his immorality or, you know, his coldness is more of a benign sort of evil. You know,
I wouldn't use the word evil at all.
Well, I'm saying in comparison to how these asshole boyfriends are usually portrayed in media.
Yes,
you know, it's a lot more realistic, but it's also kind of benign. You know, it's like, okay, he's being a dick to his friend about the paper, the thesis. He's being kind of cold-shouldered to other things going on and stuff like that. But it's not like he's burning huts or beating people up. He's just he's a douche, but he's a believable douche.
But I don't even know if he's a douche. I mean,
yeah,
he's a douche.
No, dude.
let me explain. I don't
he's
think
a dick.
Let me explain why I don't think he is. Jamie Somers on as a guest host of Chase, Cutting to the Chase, made a good point, I felt. And basically what she says and what I felt is that he was just not meant to be with her. And he's the type of guy that probably doesn't know how to break up in a relationship. I spoke with Barrett Heisner, who Abe already met, and he's on our Facebook group. He said that it was like a dependency type of relationship. She was a manic depressant, or if you prefer, bipolar, probably. He was in a situation where his friends Mark and Josh said, you know, why don't you just find another girlfriend, move on, you know, I mean, and he just couldn't because of the codependency, or he didn't know how to break it off. And maybe he was just hoping that him being cold, she would eventually just break it off herself, and yet she couldn't either because she has this dependency on him. And so I just think it was him in a relationship that had he just listened to his friends and broken up with her and moved on, he may have been fine with another person. I'm not saying that he's not a prick generally, because, I mean, he did some weird things like trying to get to do the thesis on this community similar to his buddy Josh. But the relationship, I think it was really more – both of them are just stuck in this codependent dysfunction.
You have a good point, Phil. I think we're trying to express the same thing using different words, he's not a quote unquote bad guy. He's not a good boyfriend for this person.
No, I definitely saw. I feel both. I felt like Eric, where he was definitely a real world douchebag, but I also saw this relationship as being extremely codependent. However, Phil, I do not think Danny was bipolar. They show her taking Ativan, first of all. What I kind of got from this, because thematically, it seems like Ari Aster kind of deals with the same themes. I saw some common themes with Hereditary and this between them. I could compare them easily. There's the theme of family and what happens if you're in a bad one. And he does say to Danny, the Swedish guy, the guy that brings them there, says, you know, you can choose your family. You know, is Christian a family that's going to hold you? And that's when she begins to realize that, no, he isn't. I think mental illness is a theme in this film, too. Profound grief is another one, not just the usual grief of a loss, but the grief that happens when your entire world is destroyed. And Danny's grief is so palpable. You can almost taste it. I think she was probably in this family with the sister and the mother and the father. And the sister is obviously screwed up beyond all reason.
Well, the sister was labeled as bipolar in the movie.
She was definitely bipolar. Right. But what I kind of gathered was that Danny was dealing with all of this pressure, whereas the parents were probably spending a lot more time paying attention to the bipolar sister.
Apparently
Danny
not
was
enough.
Right. But Danny was kind of ignored. Like, she didn't have that support of her family. And so she fell into this codependent relationship with this guy. And Christian, like we said, he is a little bit douchey because of what he does with the thesis. Okay, how do I put this without like pissing a lot of people off? Because it's not what I mean. All right, I'll put it in terms of myself. When you're in a, or when I'm in a place, or when I was in a place where I was really feeling weak, you know, kind of battered by the situation going on with my family, that I didn't feel supported by my family, I went off to college, and every guy I dated was sort of a douche that I became codependent on. And the reason that I was attracted to that was because guys that are not super emotional, or guys that can't like express their emotions well, and in some cases they're not even very mature, they tend to come across to, or they came across to me, who was suffering and needed something strong to hang on to, as being like the strong silent type, the person that could kind of handle everything. And so it's easy to fall into a codependent relationship with someone like that, because you tend to look at them as your hero, you know, the guy on the white horse. You know, you notice she kept calling him. She kept being like, help me, help me, help me, because she viewed him as somebody who was strong and awesome, who can do this. The reality is, like you said, Phil, he really couldn't handle her. He couldn't handle that kind of relationship. He wasn't mature enough. He's a little bit of a prick in terms of his personality. And he's a typical, you know, college, like, you know, guy. It wasn't strong enough to handle her. And so I think in this case, it's probably a little bit of both. They were not only a not good match for each other, she was totally screwed up. And that is actually an important point, because later in the movie, it is why she kind of falls into what she falls into, right? Because she wants a family that's going to support her. She wants a family to share her grief with her. And she finally finds it in this place, mm-hmm. not in Christian, which is why she burns him at the end. Because she's like, I see you for what you are now. You're not the thing I thought you were.
There's so also kind of an interesting...
That's my thought.
There's also kind of an interesting imagery with him being put into the bear. I know it's going to sound strange when I describe it, but almost like a child giving away a stuffed animal that it kind of depended
on. Oh, that's so cool. Yes. Oh, my God. That's really genius. I could see that. That makes sense.
You know, because in the first imagery we see the bear, it's a young child kind of pressing her head to the bear, kind of like depending on it. For protection, comfort, as a child would for a teddy bear or something like that, or a stuffed animal. Next time we see it, of course, we just see it as kind of like another beast in its cage, because we're still kind of left to question its purpose. And the third is when we see it burning, it finally comes full circle, is that he is the bear, the so-called protector that she believes is her quote-unquote protector, but instead something she's overly dependent on and is not really going to support her when she needs him.
Right. It's about perception. You know, she never saw him for what he really was, which was just kind of an average college guy. It was skewed through the, you know, all of her emotions and everything she was dealing with at home. And I mean, I kind of figured out what was going in her house. I thought that that scene was pretty, that opening business with the, you know, they find the body of the sister and blah, blah. And the bottle of Ativan. I mean, I thought that that opening sequence was actually done pretty well because I could totally figure out what that family dynamic was. They gave me enough information that I could figure it out. And then it came back at the end. And I was like, oh, that's really pretty good. He did that. Like, but it's almost an intangible. Like, you'd really have to, again, this is kind of why I say if you didn't have like a tragic death in your family or you haven't dealt with the consequences of mental illness on a family, you might miss pieces of this because I really think that this is, this guy obviously is an artist, is going to keep expressing this. Maybe he even lived through this kind of a dynamic because he's going to keep talking about this in his films until it's out of his system.
That's a good point. So you mean that dysfunctional families.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And mental illness.
In particular with intense mental illness. I mean, I have a very good friend whose brother is bipolar. And the hell that family has been through dealing with that illness. It is okay. It's not cancer. It's not something else terminal, but it is really, really hard to live with someone who suffers from that disorder, and the whole family suffers for it. Everybody in the family suffers for it. Everybody in the family gets messed up. It's not good. And I'm willing to bet, because I've seen it twice now, I've seen this theme in Hereditary and I've seen it in Midsommar. I'm willing to freaking bet that Ari Aster probably grew up in a home where someone had this kind of a devastating illness. I'm willing to bet. I could be wrong, but he's got some kind of bug up his ass about it because he keeps talking about it.
I think he's actually stated that in interviews.
Yeah. Has he really? Yeah. So that's why he's trying to struggle to process this, and he's doing it through his art, which is so freaking cool. I mean, I'm totally into that.
This is the second time we've kind of examined the dysfunctional family since Hereditary as well.
Well, I do hope he doesn't turn into...
right, one trick pony.
But, yeah. Right, I hope he doesn't turn into Tim Burton, who's still having issues with his daddy and middle class values. You know, after he's been making movies for and making billions of dollars off it for 40 years or 30 years. So yeah, I mean, I think you're right. The mental illness thing is obviously an important part. She's dealing with depression because she can't be bipolar. She's not manic at any point. We don't see swings. She's just down the entire time until you get kind of towards the end. Where she's finding some support. I think that's the biggest problem with Chris. If you've ever looked online on social media, for example, or just sometimes listen to what people say, when someone has an issue with mental illness and there's some idiots who come out of the woodwork and say things that it's clear they just don't know what the fuck they're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's because they've never had to deal with it. And good for them, they've never had to deal with it. That they've never had that
but
in their life.
But then also don't talk about it.
But they don't get it. They don't understand it, you know. And yeah, there are people, you know, like he's talking about the sister crying out for attention, what have you. And there are people like that. And he's probably dealt with people like that. And he's saying, just don't give her the attention. And, you know, not realizing where it goes. I'm sure there's got to be a part of her that's blaming him for what happened because he's the one that convinced her to blow her sister off.
Mm-hmm.
And then the sister, you know, does the whole murder suicide thing. But the guy's a dude, bro, right? I mean, he is mentally and emotionally immature. He's lazy,
mm-hmm.
and he has obvious and commitment issues. You know, he can't commit to a thesis. And when he does commit to a thesis, I'll just do what you're doing.
Right.
You know, and it's weird to say he has commitment issues because you know he's been with this woman for what, 3 years? They said.
Yeah.
But the problem, I mean, he's in it because he can't break up with her. Mm-hmm. And he can't break up with her not because he loves her or he's devoted to the relationship or because it would be, it's just, I can't be bothered to commit to breaking up with her.
Yeah.
You know,
he's
just kind of floating through his life the way, you know, a dude bro like that can do. And so, right, it's not. You know, if you're doing a the seven deadly sins, he's sloth, right? I mean,
yeah.
Well, again, all that stuff is fair, but again, it depends on each person individually. Obviously, you can say these things about him, but you know, a lot of people grow up a little slower than others. So,
right, and that's what he is. That's why he's a bad fit for her. She's not what he needs right now, because she needs somebody who is a more solid rock, someone who's more supportive, and he needs somebody who's probably a little bit more together and more independent, and they are a terrible, and maybe somebody that can help him grow up a little bit.
Yeah.
But, and therefore, they are the absolutely wrong people to be together.
Right.
And I kind of thought, I kind of thought the Swedish guy would have been a good match for her.
So did he.
Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if that match was kind of going to happen maybe after the movie ended. They were going to end up together.
In my fictional continuation of the story, it does.
Yeah. I think it does. I mean, he's pretty much, you know, getting her to kind of sway, you know, he's playing off the whole tension between her and Christian as a way to get closer to her.
Now, I mean, again, not to downplay people who aren't together or are together, but obviously, you could quote unquote say that she's a bit damaged. Maybe there's something wrong with her. You know, she's a very depressed person. So
she's depressed because her sister killed herself and her parents.
No, but before that,
yeah, too, she was on medication before that.
Yeah. She was very needy and all that, which is fine. But again, you know, some people don't want that extra drama in their own life. So, you know, that's why he shouldn't have been dating her. Yeah.
Yes.
And that's why he shouldn't have been dating her, because, you know,
they were not a good match. I think we can all agree on that.
Yeah. Right. I think we all agree they just weren't a good match, you know?
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
So let's talk about Mark.
Which one is Mark?
Mark is the asshole.
The guy
who pissed on the tree.
On the tree, yes.
Yeah. I don't think.
Oh my God.
I don't think he's an asshole at all.
It's amazing, Phil. You can be judgmental about everybody, but when it comes to these kind of college frat dudes, you are always there to defend them.
I don't see any issues with this kid, because his goal for this trip was just to have fun. You know, go to Europe and have fun, and that's basically what he does. So I don't call that a bad thing at all. Also,
no, he's a dumbass though. He's an inconsiderate. He's the ugly American stereotype.
Yes.
For this.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I don't know. I'm thinking Josh may be that because Mark.
They're both that. Yeah.
Maybe I still didn't see him as really an issue at all. I mean, he's just the guy that went to Europe to have a vacation with his buddies. That's all he was doing.
Well, he certainly really couldn't handle his mushrooms, I will tell you.
And that's one of the potentially humorous points of the movie.
Oh my God.
When they're like, what time is it? 9:30. What?
Yeah. I love that whole scene, because I used to go to Reggae Fest with like these five or six friends of mine. And again, I have a friend that's like Mark. His name is Kerwin. And he was just like the asshole. Like, he could never handle the opium. He could never handle the mushrooms. He could never handle the whatever it was he was taking. He would always freak out and do silly things. But the thing is, that mushroom scene where they're like, it's 9:30, what? It was like so realistic. I was like, oh my God, this looks like me and all my friends 23 years ago. This is exactly what we would have done. Like, I think everybody should lay down. Everybody just lay down.
Yeah.
Well, he was definitely the comic relief character.
He was, totally.
Because there's later, after he pisses on the sacred tree, he's just like, is that dude going to kill me?
But I love when he's like, what? It's a tree. I don't get it. Like,
it's not just a tree, but it's dead, and it's almost like a stump on the side, and no one explained anything to
And really, I think it's on them. They should probably say, hey, that's our sacred tree, you know.
But we did
we learn about the tree being sacred the same time everybody else does.
Which is before he takes a leak on the tree.
Yeah. Before he pisses on it, they do show them, like, over there putting the ashes of the people who had sacrificed themselves on the tree. It's there.
Yeah,
it is there. Okay. So you do see it. And they're watching it, in fact. Aren't they sitting there watching it?
Yes. Well, yeah. It's, it gets behind him,
actually,
but yeah.
Actually, watching them do it, even though he doesn't understand what it is, he's watching them do something over at this tree. So, and it's a ceremonial type thing. It's not just, oh, let's throw some crap over here or let's dump the wheelbarrow. It's like there's a ceremony. There's like some, you know, like they're parading around in a line, mm-hmm. right? Am I right? Well, pretty clear that they're doing something special over there.
I want to switch focus to the two English, or no, not English, but British folk, because the whole thing that upset me with this film and it made me not think these characters were sane folk is that the moment the suicide occurs of the two elders and the British folk flip out and want to leave,
mm-hmm.
the others are okay with it, or not, if not okay with it, they're upset, but they stay. And mm-hmm. and again, not that the British folk were going to be able to get out of there, because we know what happens to them. They, in my opinion, were the only ones that acted normally in this type of situation. Because the moment these people suicide, and then when the hammer is used to the head of the one that didn't die,
yeah,
that's murder. That's first degree murder. And so,
according to our laws.
Well, no, according to Swedish laws, too. So this is just insane that they could get away with this, and these Americans are like, well, all right, whatever.
It's a culture that this person has been a part of, the person, the old people that they killed. Obviously, there's murder that goes all over the place, but it's still ritualized murder, but it's a different culture. It's a different perspective. It's not murder to them. It's assisted suicide.
I know, but it doesn't matter.
Well, no, it does matter, because that's their
federal law in Sweden. That's first degree murder.
Not in this culture.
Not in that culture.
It doesn't matter. They're
it does matter. That's the whole point.
No, they're under Swedish law.
Are they?
That's Sweden, dude. You cannot in the U.S. of A. have this type of thing happen. Why would you be able to do that in Sweden? You can't.
You don't think this kind of thing happens in this country. You don't think anybody gets killed and it never gets noticed in the U.S.
No, my point is if there's a suicide and then a guy takes a hammer and kills the person that didn't die, and someone saw this and they went to the authorities, it's first degree murder.
Then I have a feeling they don't particularly respect those authorities respect those laws. But that's akin to
staying there and not leaving after this occurs.
But this is akin to, in the old feudal Japan, when a samurai would commit harikari, that he would have someone standing by him to...
But it doesn't matter.
To someone standing by to cut his head off as he commits suicide for various reasons. But it's... So there's somebody there as an assistant.
I understand all that.
Do that. And in their culture, it's not a thing. And they don't recognize those laws. They're not recognizing Swedish authority. They're living completely separate from most of the rest of that society.
I said the Americans, as the British were going to do, were going to leave and they were going to go to the authorities.
I don't know if they were going to the authorities. They were just getting the fuck out of there.
Okay, fine. And by those folks not doing so, knowing that it's illegal what they just saw in Sweden.
Here's the thing, though. You got the one guy who wants to do his thesis, right? He wants to study this culture. And this is actually the event that puts him in 100%. He's like, this is the opportunity of a lifetime. I want to do this. And then you've also got Christian, who decides to glom on and go, yeah, I want to do my thesis on this. And then there's his friend who brought him in the first place, right? And did he have the car? Whose car was it? I don't remember.
The point I'm trying to make is
them getting out of there would have been logistically difficult, even if they had wanted to do it.
Right, but you would think they would.
And they did react negatively to the whole thing before their friend explained everything to them and calmed them down.
All right, except for the British. The British didn't.
Because they weren't friends with that one dude. I honestly don't know why the British were people were there. The
British came with the brother, the kid.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah, so they were, quote-unquote, friends with this other Swede, the brother Swede.
Well, then he should have done a better job of calming them down.
Or they should have let him go, but they know... You know what I'm saying? It wouldn't matter if they calmed him down. I would still... And I think the British would have said, yeah, we still have to leave. This is not good.
I think the whole thing is moot because they were all meant to be sacrificed anyway.
Well, that's true. Yeah. I mean, it was a setup for all of them to be killed.
Yes.
Right. But and here's the thing, Phil. If you find yourself in an isolated community like this,
yep.
and you watch them commit a ritualized homicide like that, yep. my recommendation to you is not to proudly proclaim how wrong it is and you're going to leave and go tell the authorities. Just my recommendation to you.
Sure.
That you just go, huh, well, gee, I'm glad I'm not a 77-year-old person who's going to be forced to jump off a cliff. But boy, I can appreciate our cultural differences. Boy, isn't that significant. And then maybe later try to get out of there as quickly as you can without a giant flag going.
Just back away slowly.
Yeah.
Right. And that's true, Mike. That obviously would have seemed the best solution. It may be grabbing as much food as you possibly can and then backpacking it out of there or something.
But what I enjoyed about this society that was depicted in the movie is that when they explained the different cycles, it kind of made sense, right? The way they looked at it with the different cycles of life and everything. And I also thought it was funny is that their friend actually told them the truth before they saw it. Because he said, yeah, well, what happens when they hit 72? And he made like a knife cutting across his throat motion.
Right.
And that was the truth.
It was.
Yeah. Well, and the thing I did want to just comment, as long as we're talking about that moment where the couple jumps off, for Danny, that was especially traumatic because it was like watching her sister's suicide all over again. But the Americans are sitting there screaming, don't jump, don't jump. And this is part of, I think, the cultural dissonance that Astor also likes to examine. Mm-hmm. He did it in Hereditary too, where it's like a cultural dissonance, particularly with belief systems, where this belief system is different from this one and neither one can accept the other. But when the grandmother explains to them that it's a great joy to end your life, mm-hmm. she says, instead of getting old and dying and sick and in shame, they give their lives because fighting corrupts the spirit. Now, I thought that this comment was interesting just because it's kind of a comment on life in general. I want to say that it's Taoism, maybe, that talks about going along with the flow of life, that the world is already perfect, and that he who tries to change it suffers from great stress, something like that. I'd forget. I'd actually have to look it up. Somebody just emailed it to me recently, actually, the whole quote. But it has to do with, you know, those, if you fight instead of just accepting what is, that you do great disservice to your own soul. So I thought that was interesting that they were kind of bringing a Taoist element to it. But again, then we're talking about cultural dissonance with belief systems.
Well, and they're actually, there's two, sorry, Phil, I was wanting to say this before Christy even finished. There are two levels going on here that I thought was interesting. Is one is that the boyfriend's named Christian, so there's obviously the religious thing going on there, Christianity versus this pagan what we call a cult. And then there's also he very plainly puts forth the whole Americans trying to impose their way of life on everybody and disrespecting other cultures at a few different points in the movie, probably the most obvious being when there's one of their dances going on. And I forget whether it's Josh or Mark says, can I join in? And her friend goes, sure, you're an American. Just shove your way in there.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, well, that's there's a couple of things on that thing. But I guess what we find out by the end of the film, this is what I want to say, was that these people are evil because they take people unwillingly and kill them without their permission. And I'm talking about the outsiders, as they call them. So that itself shows that everything they are doing is underhanded in a sense, because
there's deception involved for sure.
Yeah. So that's bad. And second, the issue here is that it's a commune or cult or whatever you want to call it. And sure, there's a lot of these type of things, even in Western countries like Sweden and the US and whatnot, that are fine and peaceful and whatever, but this ain't one of them. And it's also very different than what some people know, especially the people that were invited as guests. And when it starts going off the handle, and obviously the suicide was most certainly something that is off the handle. It's, that's like, wow. That's when everything in theory, it definitely goes downhill from there. Mm-hmm. And we begin to find out who these people are. And that was the big part of the film, is that, all these people who are going to the cult, meaning the Brits and the Americans, these people are doomed.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, this was definitely, one thing I was saying earlier was one of my issues with Hereditary was, while there was a lot that was kind of like almost really mysterious and kind of interesting, it kind of went down to a very obvious pathway towards the second or third act. And we obviously saw where it just became a typical supernatural film. And in this case here, I started seeing a lot of the Wicker Man in this film. Obviously the whole burning and sacrifice for a harvest and everything like that. So it's just like, okay, it's so I think the stronger parts of the film are more this journey rather than the destination. Cause while there's some great, mm-hmm. Sights in the finale, it's very done before.
Yeah. Right. You know where it's going. Yeah. And as far as Phil's comments about these people being evil, I do think that's right in the fact that they are abducting people and using them for sperm donors and sacrifice. However, personally, if they've got a belief system where they want to jump off a cliff when they hit 72 years old, I don't have a problem with that.
That's true. But, obviously the reason a lot of governments don't allow that, never mind assisted suicide and all these other things.
A lot more allowing it now than used to.
That's true. And the reason something like this probably would not be approved by any government, including Sweden, is specifically for the fact they think some of these people are doing it without free will. Or if they are doing it with free will, it's because they've been brainwashed or have fear for some reason or whatnot. So even though these two people jumped willingly and whatever, you could argue that it was due to some sort of way they were taught. And
you can say that about any culture.
That, well, and I knew you were going to go there, Eric.
I know I'm right.
Yeah. Well, that's true. But again, we could say that what's wrong with the Saudi Arabians when they beat the woman and all this?
We do all the time.
Exactly, but it's not right. Right. So if they did according that in the United States,
according to our beliefs, no, it's not right.
Right. And so if they do it in the United States, they go to jail, mm-hmm. right? Or they get arrested. So these are Swedish people, whether or not they consider themselves independent from the Swedish government, they are technically doing bad things. I mean, the suicide and then with the hammer to the head, it's illegal, just as it would be if
legality enters into this movie.
Other than the traffic laws.
Well, one of the things is that I'm sure that they obviously know what they're doing is cruel. I believe that this cult is actually delusional in the sense that they are in the right because what their end goal is.
That's the perfect word, delusional.
Well, because they completely believe that this sacrifice that they have to do every so often is to keep their society, their people alive. And they see the necessary evil, or honestly, good thing, because they respond in a way of bliss, because they see it as a beautiful thing.
Well, and that's another thing that makes this film pretty cool, similar to The Wicker Man, is that there's no supernatural at all. So all the things that they do is based off of a cult slash commune slash quote-unquote religious or pagan faith.
And mushrooms.
And drugs. Absolutely. A lot of drugs, these people. So all this stuff is happening, and we, meaning educated folk, and probably more apt to look at science, know that everything they're doing is a crock. So,
well, maybe not everything, but certainly a lot of things.
Yeah.
I mean, look, they have, like I said, you know, we pointed out that there are more and more cultures allowing euthanasia after a certain age. Now, you have legitimate debates over, you know, well, is it better to just linger on forever without, you know, as you lose your mind and your body's old age continues? You know, that's a difficult question that there's not any easy answers to. But it doesn't just stop there, right? It then goes to bring other people in. Now, of course, from a societal point of view, and let's get clear, this is obviously a society that favors the collective more than the individual. They need sperm donors to avoid the problems with inbreeding. this reminded me, there is an aspect, I'm sorry I have to bring this up to you, for you, Eric, a little bit of the message, or one of the messages in Green Inferno, right, where you have the social justice warriors on campus talking about the saving the primitive cultures, and then they become a victim of those primitive cultures, you know. You know, it's this sort of, but it is a tough issue, because yes, there are values that are cultural values, and then the question is, are there values that should be more universal?
Well, one of the things in this movie that I found a little bit, I guess, disappointing, because up through a certain point of the movie, it looked like everybody that was being killed was being killed because they disrespected the culture. The dude that pissed on the tree got off because of that. The dude that takes a picture of the sacred text when he's not supposed to gets killed because of that. And up to a certain point, it looked like they were only offing people who were breaking the rules. But then we find out that's actually been the plan the whole time. So I kind of liked, I would have liked the aspect of, hey, everything would have been fine if they had just respected these people's cultures and followed the rules. But that's not the story that Ari Aster wanted to tell.
Right.
Yeah, right, right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was a setup to bring in these people so they could sacrifice them. And not just sacrifice them. They did horrible, horrible things to
them. Oh, yeah. They completely butchered them.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
you know, the blood eagle ripping off
the
face.
You say horrible. I say awesome.
And skinning them and then stuffing them like you know, the skin with straw. And,
yeah, the effigy scarecrows. Yeah.
Yeah. It's all pretty gross.
Awesome. I do have this. I would like to just bring this up because this was a question that I had. I was under the understanding that this ceremony or whatever, or this month of ceremonies or however long it goes on, only happened once every 90 years.
Correct.
Isn't that mentioned? Okay. So then I was totally confused when they did a Wicker Man homage by having all of the photos of all of the May Queens for the past however many years. And I was like, okay, but if this only happens once every 90 years, Give me the answer.
Is that the murders are only every 90 years, but
yeah,
that'd
be my guess.
Summer.
Yeah, the May Queen happens every year.
Yeah.
Okay, that was kind of what I was thinking. Yeah. But then that leads me to another question. If the murders only happen every 90 years, people turn the age of 72 all the time. So do they just kill them normally? Like
I would guess. I think it was the outside.
I was a little bit confused. I just think it needed a little more clarification.
Yeah, anyway. I think that this Midsummer Festival happens every year. May Queen happens every year. Every year there's a ceremony for anybody who is turning of age. And then once every 90 years, they do the special 9-person sacrifice.
Yeah. Well, I also think,
one person per decade.
Yeah. Well, I think the 72-year range was, I think, kind of hinted at it happens so often because when they're heading to the hill with the spot where they would jump, you would see these kind of like tombstone-like markings.
Those are the elderly. Those suicides probably happen all the time.
That's what I'm saying. I think that those 72... suicides. Things happen right. very often because with the spot they jump, you can see like tombstone like markings showing how many there are.
Right. No, we agree with that. We're talking about the nine murders.
Oh yeah, because they say 90 years or something like that.
Yeah, that's that. The bringing the outsiders to be murdered is once every 90 years.
Yeah, well, that also helps explain how they stay undetected for so long. Because they were doing it for so often, it would leave a breadcrumb.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Because when people head out to the Swedish wilderness and then just disappear, that would be pretty.
Well, especially since
every year, you know.
The last time they would have done this would have been the 1920s. So, you know, it's the forensics wasn't nearly as good as it is now.
Well, and even so, there's. I guess that the families of these people know they went to Sweden, but how much do they know about their plans after they get there? I mean, I think that little cult is pretty safe because nobody knows where the fuck they are.
Right. Yeah. That's another thing that wasn't explained in the movie too. It's because you figure everybody who heads over to Europe. I mean, you never know. I mean, in Hostel, right? They do a detour and they head to Slovakia from Amsterdam. Mm-hmm. So, and maybe they didn't call people at home and say, yeah, we're actually doing this now. And maybe these people are similar to that, where they're just morons and don't let, you know, people know where they are, you know. But a lot of, especially if it's only for, a month or whatever. But you're right. I mean, most people would have everything where contact numbers, what our location, all these other things. And so when they disappear, the cops would eventually show up there, whether they can prove anything happened. You know, they could just say, oh, they left. I don't know what you're talking about.
I think
about.
There's also a tendency that in the modern age, because you can contact anybody at any time,
mm-hmm.
that you're less likely to give a complete itinerary of this is my hotel, this is where I'm going to be on this day, mm-hmm. this is where I'm going to be on that day. It's just kind of...
For instance, my older brother has been traveling for like the last year, and I get a vague update every now and then, but I couldn't accurately tell you where he is at this exact point in time.
Does his father
somewhere in Europe?
Does your father know, or his in-laws know?
Maybe.
Okay.
So, I guess we're saying at the same time, I think it would be pretty easy for this particular cult to get away with this because these people, family, all they know is that they went on vacation in Sweden.
Well, that brings up another question, and I also just want everybody to understand that I'm being nitpicky, and I certainly don't expect...
I think you have the right to, because
you know, well, I think but awesome. I mean, there, but I don't expect... I'm going to see a fictitious film, and anytime I go into a fictitious film, I just like when I write a story or when I read a book, I do expect to have to have some certain suspension of disbelief about certain things. For example, I found it a little weird that these people, I mean, this is today's college kids, right? Where's the Facebook? Where's the Instagram? Where's the whatever the hell that shit is they do? Snapchat?
Twitter.
Like, not Twitter. Like, none of that was happening in this. And I couldn't, yeah. Well, so I was like, okay, so what time are we actually in, or did he just deliberately not deal with it? Because that is a sticky wicket to deal with in horror films particularly.
Well,
what do you do now that there's so much communication that everybody can find you? You know what I mean? It's hard.
Well, right. Never mind the fact that when they disappear, the law can, you know, detect the last time. That's how they found the murderer in Utah, that girl that was kidnapped and murdered in Utah, was they found out that her phone and his and the murderer's phone were located together at this park. And so eventually, you're right, they could find them through even GPS the phone. But they did have phones in this because that's how Josh was going to take pictures of the religious book, because he was using his cell phone to take the pictures.
Yeah, he was.
So it has to be modern era because it was their smartphones. Now, whether or not they have...
I don't know if they went through the exercise of, oh, I don't get a signal.
It, offhandedly.
Did they?
Okay. They did?
Yeah, because they're trying to look up things on the certain cultures and certain names and stuff like that, and they couldn't get a connection.
Oh, right. Right, that's right.
Okay, so they were going to Wiki, right. And they couldn't bring it up because, yeah, okay, rather than saying, gee, I don't have cell service.
Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. So they did it. A little differently.
Yeah, they just kind of went, you know, did, as an aside, but yeah, they addressed it briefly. But, you know, as soon as he did that, they just kind of went right back to, the task at hand.
But I also think in terms of social media, this is one of those things that, you know, if you were making a movie in the 60s or 70s, you wouldn't get older people going, well, kids watch TV all the time nowadays. Why aren't they all watching TV in this movie? It's because it's not interesting, right? It's just not an interesting story component for the most part to, you know, watch Christian, you know, Instagram or to watch Mark Snapchat. You know, it's just not interesting to the story. It's not interesting to the viewers. You know, it's certainly not interesting enough in real life.
Well, I'm just saying I didn't give it a second thought until you guys brought that up. But like, if you think back to Chernobyl Diaries, they handled all of that very interestingly. They gave you like 5, like maybe 10 seconds in the beginning of them like posting on their phones, like playing around over some music, and then it was done. So you got the point that, yes, they were telling people, at least in Chernobyl Diaries, where they were going and blah, 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 and there were people out there in the world that knew kind of what was going on because they had posted, but they only did it in five seconds flat. It was like a montage. I'm just saying, I was just wondering, that's all. It was like a random thing.
It's just something he didn't want to deal with, that would be my guess. And by the way, which we've said before, in the whole nitpicky thing, you know, this is a movie that takes itself seriously, and movies that take themselves seriously deserve to be nitpicked. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about Crawl next week, that is not a movie that asks you to take it seriously.
That's true.
Yeah. You know, and so you can, your suspension of disbelief can be a little bit larger than it should be here. Now, I don't think they have to have everything covered, but there should be, at least a fairly internally consistent universe. So, which is why I don't have a problem with him ignoring social media, because he's not addressing it. So I'm not going to worry about it.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, and there, the other thing, you know, going back to the every 90 years thing, I didn't really see that once you guys answered my question, which is kind of what I suspected anyway. I really didn't see the need to make a big deal out of it being every 90 years. Why couldn't have just been every year and left it?
Sure. No, and that's a good point.
We need that. Like, you know what? Then,
I'll say this, is that I don't think I think he wanted to make events special. So I think that's why he made it every 90 years. So this is like a really like rare occasion and why it's important and all that.
Yeah.
And he didn't care, meaning that Astor doesn't care about the aftermath of the film when people come, you know, the cops follow the GPS and they come to the thing and say, we're looking for missing people, and then they find the May Queen and ask her, you know, where's your friends and whatever. I don't think he cares about any of that, because once the film ends, it's like, okay, the story's done. Who cares? It's not important.
Yeah, it's similar to how, you know, the whole thing in Hereditary where the cult gets what it needs, but we never know what happens next.
Right.
Well, also, I think he fundamentally wants you to like these people, the town people, not the village people. That's wrong. But yes, which is going to be a little bit harder to do if they're murdering people every year. You know,
that's true.
Well, I mean, I
for most people, this is, as I said, this is a once in a lifetime event. You know, they are, you know, by the time many of them were not alive the last time it happened. Actually, none of them could have been, because they only lived 72 years.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So no one goes through this more than once. Mm-hmm. Well, no one has to go through this more than once.
Well, and that's an issue if he was trying to make us like the town folk, because I mean, when we see the Blood Eagle and we see the ripped off face, I mean, again, these characters, no one really cares about these characters. I mean, the characters that go to the commune are unsympathetic as well as the people at the commune. But again, it's like, I'm not going to be liking these characters at the commune because they're scumbags. So I don't think that was Astor's intent. I just can't believe that was his intent, because especially after he makes such murderous things and even kills a bear, and you got so he's pissing off the animal lovers. But go on.
Well, I mean, I think even if it's not the case, even if it was never his intention to make the characters we follow sympathetic, I think it was mostly just going on this really screwed up journey with them.
Yeah, I think that's a better thing. I like two things. One, what Abe said, which is it's a screwed up journey and it's interesting. And what Chrissy said, which is this guy, meaning Astor, is dealing with ideas from his own experiences and putting it into art.
Well, and, but and as Eric was pointing out, though, the people that he kills for most of the film, I won't say they're asking for it, but no, they do violate. But they certainly violate certain taboos, right? So these are not the most sympathetic people in the world.
Well, Josh, I'll say Josh. Josh is probably the worst of the bunch because he was told you can't take pictures, and then he sneaks in the middle of the night to do so. And so, and even that's not evil, but it's definitely
very
disrespectful. Disrespectful and
disrespectful. Stupid. Yes.
The others, the Brits did nothing wrong. Mark, you know, he probably didn't understand that it was quote unquote a special tree, and because I didn't even know either. And Christian was maybe a prick to his girlfriend and to maybe Josh a little bit, but he wasn't necessarily ever a prick to the town folk. And then the girl, Danny, she really wasn't disrespectful either to anybody. So I don't think any of them deserved it. Josh was the closest to deserving it, and even that, it was more disrespect, not being executed.
Yeah, Mark had been an ass throughout the whole film, though.
But was he an ass to the people? He was not. He was never an ass to the Swedes. Was he an ass to the Swedes? I mean, when he was hanging out with his buddies, when he's hanging out with his buddies, he says, dude, you should dump her. Come on, find someone that's...
I don't really think it's the case of being an asshole. I think it's more of being a genre oblivious to be like, hey, this is a very stupid thing. You should probably be very careful. I mean, because he's easily baited to just follow this girl he has never talked to once into the woods.
Right, but again, he was there for different reasons than everybody else. He was there because he should have been on the beaches of Miami, hanging out with the bars and the chicks. Or he should have been downtown Stockholm.
Clarify this for me. Yep. Did they lie to him to get him there?
I don't think he was expecting what he was expecting. When he said Sweden, he was thinking of vodka and blonde chicks.
But when they got Danny involved, their Swedish friend was pretty upfront about what they were doing when they got there. Did they not tell him that?
But I think when
or is he just oblivious?
I think he's oblivious because when you say we're going to have this big festival, that's huge. He was thinking probably Mardi Gras.
Okay, fair enough.
Which because that is the way a person like that, I would think, would kind of think. You say festival, you think Mardi Gras, you know, open container, beer, tapas, women. Like, that's what you think.
And he saw the pictures, right? The Swedish guy showed him these pictures of you know, the chicks in hippie clothes, and he just talks about mushrooms, and you know, and so he's like, "Oh, all right, this sounds pretty cool." And
false advertisement.
Yeah. Speaking of topless women, the sex scene. there's a scene where Christian gets drugged and then seduced. They want him to impregnate one of their women, this redhead. And so they give him this special tea and then take him into this building where there's the redhead, naked, ready for him. And then there's like, is it 12 other women?
Women.
They're standing in a semicircle.
Yeah.
All nude. And so they bring him in and have him have sex with the redhead. And I don't know about your audience, but like, there's a point where he's having sex with this redhead, and one of the women comes out of the semicircle and comes over and holds the girl's hand and starts singing. And the second that she starts singing, she startles the dude that's having sex with her redhead. and he has this completely panicked look on his. I don't know about you guys, but my audience just erupted in laughter at that moment. How about yours?
I didn't have as many people as you probably did, but people did giggle for sure.
Yeah, the part that really had people giggling was when Christian got the assist from behind.
I'll say one thing: the rating system in the States anyway must have changed, because I remember, like 10 or 15 years ago, you could show a sex scene, but you couldn't show the pumping. And this one was showing the pumping. and yet it's still got an R. Well, if this was like 15 years ago, it would have got NC-17 or unrated, or it would have had to be like a HBO. Okay. So it must have changed a bit. So I was very surprised when I saw
it. It really
this.
Depends on – there's a lot of inconsistency with the MPAA ratings and who's on it. And sometimes they'll give one movie a rating, an R rating, where they'll give another movie an NC-17 rating or another movie a PG-13. And there's no great consistency.
Well, and looking at the trivia here on IMDb, apparently this movie – originally was rated NC-17, and that half an hour that got cut was due to content to get it an R.
Okay, so really? They probably or old lady snatch.
Wait, so it was actually another half hour of stuff.
Yeah, there's a rumor that when it comes out on disc, that it's going to be extended. So yeah, it's going to be like over 3 hours the movie. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, when I heard that there was an extra 30 minutes that was potentially out there, I was kind of like, all right, we definitely don't need another 30 minutes. I mean, it was fine the way it was, but I was like, I don't know what they could expand on. And I get, for example, one of the things I thought that could have been shaved down a little bit was the whole thesis subplot. That just went on and on. I was like, okay, if you really needed to cut 15 minutes out of this movie, you could have cut that. Yes, you needed it to show that Christian was kind of a dick. You do need the thesis subplot so that the kid makes a mistake and photographs the book. I get that. But it was too long. It just went on too long.
It also gives exposition.
Yeah.
From something I read, I think that Ari Aster was kind of laughing about the final product. Because if you're paying attention, they say it's supposed to be a 9-day ceremony and they only show like 3 days. And he's like, that's like all that 30 minutes that got cut was the other days of the ceremony. And he's like, so it's kind of funny to me with the end product, cause you only see 3 days. So like, if this is what's happening on day three, what the hell comes next?
That's true. Recovery. It would have gotten more intense as it went on, not less intense.
Right.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it'll be curious to see what's in that 30 minutes because I can't believe he would have cut out a lot of the uncomfortable stuff because that's the stuff that is what makes the film, you know, important, I think.
Well, and the other thing that got a lot of, like, very upsetting laughter in my, you know, nervous laughter in my audience was this scene where all the women were crying with her.
Oh, right.
And you know what's really weird about that? Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Somebody went hello, and I was like, oh, you can't hear me. What's really weird about that is almost everybody in my audience was laughing when those women started imitating her grief.
Uh-huh.
I freaking started crying. Really sad. I was like,
Christy.
I get this girl. She just wanted somebody to understand her. This is so freaking sad. And that's how I knew she was going to end up staying there in the end. Because I was like, here's her family.
Well, I think the reason people were laughing was what Eric said, which is it was like the nervous, uncomfortable, because it's like crazy. And it doesn't, I don't think they're laughing because they go, ah, that's funny. That's great stuff. I think they were laughing because it's uncomfortable.
Well, and the same thing at the end, when they light the fire, they're all reacting along with those people too that are burning. All the worshipers are running around screaming in grief and pain. So it's like a communal emotion. And like Christy just said, I think that's what Danny really, really wants. She wants people to sympathize with her, empathize with her, and she finally found a home with these folks.
Right, yeah. Because there's certain people. My mother used to work at the University of Lowell, or UMass Lowell, as it's called now, where Abe got his degree. And she used to see certain groups. I won't say what religious groups, but you can probably figure out who they are, would zero in on folks that were loners, misfits, things like that, and or depressed, whatever. And so she was one of those people, whether it was manic depression slash bipolar or whether it's just being depressed and lonely, as you think, Chrissy. She was the type of person that could break and become one of these type of people who would be susceptible to these extreme groups, I guess.
Yeah, one of the things about cults and things like that, they try to find the people who are almost like separated from the rest of the herd of the greater collective. Mm-hmm.
That's true.
And that makes it easier to convert and to convince, because it goes, there those who don't understand you, but I do. And that allows them to appeal to whatever senses that loner, that person, for whatever reason, is trying to find some acceptance.
Right.
And it's how they take advantage of people. You know, it's like how the leader of that cult who the poison punch.
Jim Jones.
Yeah, Jim Jones. Yeah. And how he managed to gather so many people because he managed to make the community seem attractive and just prosperous and everything like that, even though it was far from it. But he was able to appeal to that whatever sense those people were longing for.
And that's right. The disenfranchised. Right. Cults very often will
target the weak, lonely.
The disenfranchised. Right, exactly. But it's interesting, too, because on a related note, at the end, when they anoint the Swedish guy, I forgot his name. The Swedish, because I liked him, even though he was part of the cult. Swedish guy who brought them there.
It began with an I, his name, I think. It was Ingmar. Ingmar, wasn't it? Oh, no, that was his brother.
No, that was his brother. Pele. They extol him at the end, you know, and they're like, he's going to be honored and all of this. And they say something, I don't remember the exact line, but I think it was something like, you have brought us good sacrifices this year, but you've brought us great sacrifice, like something to the effect of the people that he brought were especially good, not just good sacrifices, but they were like awesome sacrifices because they were so screwed up. Like that was just kind of what I picked up. Do you know the line I'm talking about?
Yeah, because Chrissy, you're absolutely right, because it was already foreshadowed throughout the film, because Pele kept on telling Danny that, oh, you're perfect, and I'm so glad you're here. You fit up. And what he was really saying was, like you said, which is she's fucked up, and she's perfect. And that's what these elders were saying to him at the end, when you say, oh, you brought excellent people, because they're all freaking fucked up. You know, Josh is a narcissist. Mark is just, you know, the frat boy.
Well, he's a
Christian.
Fool. He's the
Christian,
fool.
Okay, fool, whatever. But Christian and Danny are messed up completely and whatnot. While Ingmar brought what appears to be fairly normal people, and that's why they flipped out.
That's one, true.
And then they had to take them out quick.
And and what's interesting too is the way that the human effigies are dressed. The British couple, for example, were filled with fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Mark had a jester's hat on. That's why I said he was a fool. There's a piece of parchment shoved in Josh's mouth,
symbolizing that he would have been the wise one.
Yeah,
right. Because he was the one writing the thesis, so he was their wise man. Right. Yeah. Well, let's see. Keep going, and then I'll say what I was going to say. Go ahead.
Okay. And then, of course, two of the village people had to sacrifice themselves as well. Yep. And then there was Christian, who was put into the bear, I guess it was supposed to symbolize some kind of dark one they kept referring to.
Right, right, yeah. And he could have been spared. I don't know what would have happened if they did spare him. But what happened was she chose him, and so he landed up as the bear, which was the fifth outsider, or the fifth, or ninth spot, I should say. And that was the spot that represented the evil, I guess.
Well, and that's interesting because I just figured this out just as Abe was talking. That's like the four archetypes that exist inside each one of us that have to be in balance, right? You have the lover, the warrior, the sage, and the fool. And right. So the sacrifices of the four people, you know, right? Mark is the fool.
Yeah.
And then we have the lover, obviously. Well, anyway, I don't know where I was going with that. But anyway,
which
matches
one is Key
the
up?
Four.
That's what I want to know.
Yeah, Key Up was obviously Mark. But yeah, but the sage, the wise man, who is the guy who was doing his thesis.
Yeah.
Right. So how many of them were there? And then Danny is the lover. And the warrior is what's his name? The warrior is Christian.
Christian, yeah. Well, Christian. I think that might also tie back, if we think about it this way, to him as the bear, as Danny's protector, or what she believed to be her protector, and also just her comfort, which she discards to the fire because she feels she realizes she decides that she didn't need him anymore.
Yep.
Right.
Yeah, she plus her family.
Well, also, I think it may have been Lacey Liu on Cut to the Chase podcast that did this film, and it may have been Jamie, who was the guest host, where she said a woman scorned has, you know, no fury. So he was fucked no matter what, especially from a damaged person, right? Because he cheated on her even though he was drugged out of his mind and it really wasn't his fault necessarily.
Well, no, he knows, right? He knows what's going on at this point. He's seen the tapestry. He chooses to – he kind of just says fuck it and drinks it. And I think we have a pretty good idea he knows what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Maybe. All right.
Well, and I do have to give this society credit because I am convinced that every single thing they ate or drank in this was like hallucinogenic.
Well, and that was one of the awesome things about this movie is
hallucinogenics all the time.
That last dinner, the last feast scene, like everything is just undulating. The food on the table, the buildings in the background, everything's just got this movement going on with it. This like undulation, and it's really trippy. He did a really good job with that.
Did you also notice that they kept showing the long banquet table from up above, and like toward the right of the screen there was like a naked woman's breasts and torso, and the food items were actually made to look like naked bodies? Did you guys notice that?
Yeah,
that was pretty cool. I wanted to get a better look at it, but I could, you know, I couldn't. It was kind of quick. But I thought that was really creepy and interesting and weird. But yes, undulating is totally the right word. And it was just enough trippiness, Eric.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Because yeah, sometimes you wasn't over the top.
Like, oh, I'm going to make this like The Doors and like really make it, you know, so that we don't know what the fuck is going on. He didn't do that. He made it really realistic. I don't know if any of you guys have tripped before. I have.
I have not. I don't trust my brain under normal circumstances.
Yeah.
I'd
be too scared. Too scared to do it.
I did it one time, and fortunately I did not have a bad trip, but I decided that I would never do it again after that just to be safe, because I've seen people that have had bad trips and it is not pretty, and I was always afraid of that. So I was like, but it is kind of like that. Like the time that I experienced it, it was very similar to what he was showing. Like kind of things kind of had a shimmer to them. They were kind of moving when they weren't moving. You know, things seemed to get larger and smaller as you looked at them. It's interesting. I wouldn't really I'm not going to recommend to everybody that you go try it, obviously, but so yeah,
it's
he did
not for everybody.
Exactly.
So to answer, everybody's going to be, it's kind of like alcohol. Some people can handle it better than others.
Yeah. But to answer your question, Eric, yes, or to echo what you said, yes, he did an awesome job with it because it was pretty damn close to the real thing, I felt.
Well, and it also was I don't know if subtle is the right word, but it was not in your face. Like there were, like I heard people whispering in the theater as they noticed it. Oh my God, look at that thing's moving. I thought it was pretty cool.
Indeed. Yeah, it was weird, like the flower, the rose, or whatever, daisy, whatever it was, people were saying and whispering in the audience, look, the flower's moving.
Mm-hmm. The one in her bonnet, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, yeah, the flower, it's like an eye almost.
Right, but again, I assume we're looking through Christian's perspective, because he's the bear, right? And when that happens, they wake him up and they say, don't worry, you can't move or speak, but you can see what's going on. And then that's when we see the flower moving and things like that. At least that's what I think.
So back to one more thing that made my audience laugh. I'm wondering if you guys had the same reaction as during the actual May Queen ceremony when they're all dancing. And there are a few different times when girls just like slammed into each other.
Oh, yeah, yep.
Every time that happened, my audience laughed. What about yours?
I didn't really have many people in my theater talk for that kind of reaction. Okay. I got to chuckle at myself because I can believe that in those kind of chaotic dances and stuff like that, people can be running around just... I mean, I think most of them were drugged up, too.
Right.
Yeah.
And then at the end, when Danny starts speaking in Swedish, she's like, oh my god, I can understand you.
Oh, that was fantastic. I thought it was funny because it was kind of on the hallucinogenic end and it was sort of amusing, but I also thought it was interesting because at that point in the movie I was already kind of pretty sure that Danny was going to end up staying in this community.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, this is symbolic of the fact she can suddenly understand them because they are her real family. But yeah, that was funny. And the other thing, darn it, I just lost it, that I wanted to mention. I'll think of it. You guys go ahead, and I'll think of what it was I wanted to say.
I was done.
Okay, fair enough. Well, if we pick up, let's talk about the Blood Eagle. That was pretty gross. Someone said, actually, I think it was Jamie, again, from the Cut to the Chase podcast, she said that he was still alive.
Yes, because the lungs were moving.
Yep.
Right, but again, was that just hallucinating because he was all drugged up and effed up?
It's something that's a part of interpretation.
When I was watching the movie, that's what I thought, is that it was a hallucination. But I listened to that same podcast, Phil, and she said that's actually a thing that they do.
Yeah.
And the reason they do it that way is to keep the person alive and make them suffer more. Yeah. So I believe it was still alive.
Yeah. The one thing that was question, it was a cool and freaky shot, but the thing I was wondering was, like, what was the purpose of it, though? It was just, you know, I could understand, like,
just killing. Part of a stupid sacrifice. I mean, what was the purpose of them showing them in a beer and burning them? You know, I mean,
it's
stupid.
What I'm saying is, it's just like
they're furries.
I can see the bears being symbolizing the dark one, but I wasn't sure why the fuck they had them in the fucking chicken coop and shit like that.
They're furries.
It's a chicken coop.
That was a grenade. Mike tossed it like 5 seconds later. Chrissy started laughing.
That's because I had a mouthful of soda and I was sitting here trying not to drown. Still
talking. So here's one of the problems I had at the end. I couldn't tell which victim was which.
Right, because they lost at that point.
Well, I know that, but who was the bear? Who was the eagle? Who was the
right. That was the British boyfriend.
So they
took
him off the Blood Eagle and then put him in the firehouse.
So why was he the Blood Eagle?
That's what I was wondering.
I would have expected it to be the fool. But, right, so, like, yeah, so, like, at the end when you're bringing the scarecrows in, I was thinking that the first scarecrow they brought in was Chris, and then we see Chris later, and then it was no other, because it was the one with the fool hat, and that obviously was Mark. But I just had trouble making out some of the faces for obvious reasons.
Right.
But...
yeah, I don't know how. I mean, obviously, Chrissy, you mentioned, you know, the lover and the whatever. But again, I don't know how or why they would choose who for what. I mean, obviously, they had to take out the British people because they were flipping out and they were leaving. And Josh, I guess they were going to take out because he was taking pictures, and then obviously didn't want him to upload them, assuming the network worked. So those people are going to be taken out. Why they chose to Blood Eagle the British guy, I have no idea. And why, maybe because he offended them or something?
Well, and you know what we're also kind of forgetting here is that there was, like I said, this world and this culture had been beautifully and painstakingly created. All of the drawings and the sketches on the walls. I mean, you'd have to buy this movie to just watch it frame by frame to look at all of the symbolism and wonderful things that were on the walls, like in the witch's house there and all of that, where the whole wall is just covered with like nothing but symbols. So my point is, what we don't know is some of what they did in terms of the effigies could have just been a reflection of their culture, which was all, you know, written on the walls and all these houses and everything, but we just didn't get a chance to get a good close-up look at it. I mean, maybe not everything had a reason. Do you know what I mean? Maybe it was just like, oh, right. Well, you know. Maybe you know.
We didn't have the perspective of the British folk, right? So, or even Mark, for that matter, when they were killed, he was killed. So, you know, who knows if the British folk was started punching people and kicking things.
Right. We don't know what happened with the boyfriend and the people that took him away. Because yeah. The girlfriend, like we find out about it third hand. The girlfriend's like, where is he? And they're like, oh, we took him into town. She's like, wait, what?
Yeah. Decided to take the train back to Stockholm and then fly home. Without me. You know, so she knew that was a crock. So then they had to take her out because she was beginning to flip out. But again, we don't know what they did. Right. And we don't know what Mark did when he was taken away. The only people we know are Josh, Christian, and Danny. And that's it. What how their fates occurred. The others were off screen, so we don't know. Yeah.
Well, we know Mark lost his face.
Right, but it was off screen. Well, and we know the British guy was blood eagled. But again, we don't know what led up to it. Did they flip out? Were they easy kills like Josh? You know, we just don't know.
Let's talk about the Oracle.
Yeah.
Because
I have not done any research on this, but
you heard the same podcast as me, Eric, about like their whole religion is based off of pictures by a person that has issues. But go on. Well, not issues, but issues because he was
inbred. Yeah. They intentionally inbreed the Oracle. But the appearance of the Oracle was disturbing, but also didn't look real to me. It looked like a head made out of papier mache. And my question is, do any of us know, are there actually people that look like that?
At first, when I saw someone, I thought he was suffering from
encephalitis.
Encephalitis, something like that.
Yeah, but yeah, whatever that.
Encephalitis is a parasite, but I could see stuff like that. So yeah, it wouldn't surprise me if it was real or real enough.
Okay. Because I was just like, whoa, what? Yay.
did the culture itself like kind of make him look like that? Do you know what I mean? That was my question.
Say they intentionally bred people to be
your
and have when this you issue. But in all fairness though, when you interbreed, there's no guarantee that you're going to get something that looks like that. I mean, an inbred person, contrary to a lot of popular belief, does not always look obviously like an inbred person.
Oh, I agree with you. A brother and sister.
So how do you know what you're going to get?
A brother and sister could have children, which they did in the past, you know, back in the Stone Ages, whatever. And there's only a certain percentage that you're going to have a problem.
It increases the risk of genetic disorders.
Just increases. You're right. So this movie doesn't explain anything about, because they don't ask the question, which is, but how do you know you're going to get this, the Oracle?
Well, and maybe the appearances,
you may not.
Maybe the appearance is irrelevant and they just need somebody that's inbred.
That's what I was thinking. It was more,
No, that's not true, because they specifically said this type of individual is an Oracle because they don't have the thought process like we do.
What does that have to do with how they look?
Yeah.
I honestly think
that's a fair point. Right? Yeah.
Perhaps it was just mainly disturbing for the sake of being disturbing rather than any purpose, as similar to the Blood Eagle.
Aster made him look like that because it is more disturbing.
Because it's upsetting.
Yeah, fair enough.
Well, I mean, it
could have been "quote unquote" simple-minded and looked normal as well. Yeah. You're right.
Well, it's also similar to how when the guy gets the old man gets his face smashed in the first time, he's already dead. They pass the freaking hammer to other people to keep giving extra wax, you can't. It's like, why would you do that? The guy's already dead. But it's just shocking that they're all doing it. So I think some of these things are don't really have so much explanations, but are just there for the fact of being unsettling and upsetting.
Right. Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right. Because I mean, he doesn't even have to show the head splatter. Right. I mean, he could just show them swing the hammer like some horror films do, and not actually show the outcome. Mm-hmm. So you're right, a lot of this is for shock value as well, or to make you feel uncomfortable, and to have the simple-minded folk be also deformed.
Hideously deformed. Yeah.
Yeah. It makes it more disturbing, mm-hmm. and then just for the fact that his pictures are just like junk. And they actually can interpret it.
Those are religious texts, Phil.
Well, and that's the thing. That
God
that,
damn it. Show some respect.
That's the thing that makes this even more scary, because we know... Well, unless they're actually, tricking themselves, that priest that is interpreting that stuff is interpreting it based off of his own biases, and he knows... And mine.
Oh, absolutely.
He knows it.
Well, that's... Well, let's not get into that discussion.
Well, maybe not. Maybe, Phil, maybe you're just like Sylvester Stallone in that you don't understand how to use the three seashells, and everybody else does. Nobody else saw Demolition Man? Just.
Yeah, no, I kind of got your joke, but
so in other words, like, they, to them, his pictures and shit may be perfectly clear.
Oh, well, that could be true in their mind, but we know that it's all nonsense, because this isn't a supernatural film. So we know that this is a person that is just looking at pictures and interpreting them, or quote unquote claiming to interpret them.
I don't know. She magically starts speaking their language.
We don't really know that, though, do we?
I mean, I'm just saying, it's like, we don't know that there is magic.
We don't know that. Advocate.
Well, right. I'm saying we don't know necessarily. I mean, we don't.
So you're saying that it is supernatural, this film.
I'm saying I didn't see any evidence one way or another, but I don't know that culture. That culture seems to think so.
Oh, no, I understand the culture. I'm saying, do you think this was a supernatural horror film or a cult horror film that wasn't supernatural and it just was horrific because of what happened?
I didn't see any evidence necessarily of something supernatural. I'm just saying, I am not, just because somebody is deformed and retarded doesn't mean that he doesn't know how to draw pictures that can be understood by the wise man of the village.
Fair enough.
This is going off the rails.
I love it. The quote unquote wise man. Oh, yeah, that's great. Well, that's the thing. All right, but you know what? Certain cultures, primitive cultures, foreign cultures, whatever, are all as legit as our own culture. But since this is a movie, I'm going to say it straight out. This culture is fucked and stupid. And that's that.
I don't know, man. I would love to be eating and drinking whatever it is they eat and drink all the time, because they seem to feel pretty damn good 24 hours a day.
Right. I think the argument to their society is compare their society to our society. You know, you look at what they have to sacrifice every 90 years to mm-hmm. get the society they have. Now, I couldn't handle that sort of conformity. I couldn't handle that sort of touchy-feeliness, you know.
I would be insane after 2 minutes.
You know, but there are a lot of people, and that's, you know, that's why cults work. There's a lot of people who look for that sort of connection, you know. So, you know, there are people that would be a great society, and it would be worth that sacrifice to them. You know, the only problem being that not every sacrifice is a willing sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, you know, it's, you know, like,
well, we could argue that even if they didn't kill anybody, their culture would still live on fine.
Yeah.
Because all.
Or maybe there is something magical to it. I don't know. They certainly believe it. I mean.
Well, okay, that's fair. I mean, people have their superstitions and whatever and so forth. I'm sure.
Well, if you're Catholic, you go to church on Sundays and eat of the flesh and drink of the blood of a Jew who's been dead for 2,000 years.
That's right from the Exorcist.
We all have cultural things that seem pretty fucking weird to outsiders.
Yeah, it's just that the murdering is the problem, Mike. I think that's the problem. You know, I mean, if they want to do whatever they want to do and belly dance, and
I don't think it's a problem because this is a horror movie, so I'm fine with it.
Right? It's like you said, Eric. It's awesome. When he walks in with the face and goes, and Josh just gets his head slammed.
Oh, I remember what I was going to say. Poor bastard. I remember what I was going to say back when we were talking about how she was going to become part of it and she was dancing.
Mm-hmm.
I have to say that what little folklore or legends and lore of this culture that they did explore verbally, that one was really brilliant. Here we're going to celebrate this whatever when this somebody or whatever forced all of the women to dance themselves to death. And I just thought that was fantastic. I was like, that is some very inventive storytelling. Like, I tried to write it down, but it was like so specific. I guess I will have to get this movie again and watch it just to pick up.
Let's talk about that, Chrissy.
I was just going to say, I'm still not sure if I like this movie or not, but I've already committed to buying it on disc.
I'm just curious. Let me ask you this. We brought Dax up, and I think, I don't know if it was you, Eric, or Barrett Heisner, because I was talking to him about the film too, through text. Did they intentionally let her win or not to become May Queen?
That's a great question. I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's interesting.
She may just have more stamina because she's not inbred.
Well, I mean, because, yeah, what if she didn't win that whole thing? Would she just been another sacrifice then?
Right.
Maybe.
Well, holy crap. So just for the hell of it, I'm sitting here and I Google dance yourself to death, right? And this is what comes up. I guess this is a real thing. The Dancing Plague of 1518 was a case of dancing mania that occurred in Strasbourg, Alsace, now modern-day France, in the Holy Roman Empire in July of 1518. Around 400 people took to dancing for days without rest, and over the period of about 1 month, some of those affected collapsed or even died of heart attack, stroke, or exhaustion.
Jesus.
So there actually were people in the 1500s who danced themselves to death.
Sweet.
Right.
Now, that's pretty cool. Wow. Wait. Modern theories about why this occurred include food poisoning caused by the toxic and psychoactive chemical products of ergot, which is what it's a fungi that grows in like grains, I think.
Oh, that's the same thing from End of the Line.
Yes. And the ergot has also been suspected in the witch trials, the Salem witch trial, that was used for baking bread. Ergotamine, if I'm probably not pronouncing that correctly, is the main psychoactive product of ergot fungi. It is structurally related to the drug lysergic acid, so acid, LSD, and is the substance from which LSD was originally synthesized. Wow, that's really cool that's cool. I gotta think about this.
But what about in this film here? Did they intentionally let her win?
Nobody knows, Phil. Nobody can answer that question.
Yeah. And it doesn't matter because she did.
Yep.
Because it asks a lot of questions, which if she didn't win, like Abe said, and some other people that I've heard, then the film would be completely different.
But she did win.
Well, here's the thing. If she didn't win.
But she did win.
Let me just walk through. You're right. She did. But if she didn't. This whole thing is already set up. They have already, in the dancing, she is gotten enmeshed in the culture, right? By the end of the dance, she's speaking the language. She has been sucked into their community. Then another person would have had to choose between Chris and the villager. And I have a feeling the other person still would have chose Chris instead of the villager, because why wouldn't you pick the outsider? So I don't think it fundamentally would have done anything. It just wouldn't have had the same narrative resonance necessarily.
Right. And I would be curious if at a certain point she just quits and falls down. I mean, and she didn't do that, though. I mean, it was almost like she was clueless. And again, it may be because she was drugged up, right? Yeah, because she drank that weird tea that was druggy. And
maybe it was destiny, Phil. Do you have to think about that?
Could be Eric. I don't know. But anyway, it was just something curious that a lot of people were bringing up. Because it was interesting to see the outsider win it when, had she not, the whole film would be completely different, the last 20 minutes, which is kind of interesting.
I have to say her flower outfit was pretty freaking silly.
Yeah, some people said it was cool. Awesome, too. Some people said it was awesome.
No, I thought it was really cool, except for the hat. The hat, I really didn't like. I was like, what is that silly thing that's like a bubble on top? Like, it would have just been cooler if it had just been a big wreath.
I don't know. It was
better. I don't know. Just looks stupid to me.
Maybe in profile it was okay, but when she was trying to move around in the thing, it was just kind of silly.
And I think a lot of those cultural things are just bizarre sometimes. You know, those sort of folkish things, they get exaggerated. They end up in museums and people wore that?
Right,
so that felt, the fact that they pushed it that extra dimension felt kind of real to me.
Right, yeah. And obviously Astor was trying to make it look like out of this world in a sense. You know, or alien, if you want to call it. Because, go on, Abe.
Well, I think it also kind of maybe, you know, thinking about it in terms of the themes and presentation-wise, it kind of really shows their place of standing, where she becomes essentially a goddess while Christian falls to the level of a sacrificial beast.
Right. Well, he becomes... Right. Yeah. I mean, she becomes a goddess while he... Whether or not they sacrificed him, he would have just been another person, right? Because she could have chose the other guy.
Right? Well, the point is that where they end up at the end, you know, because... She elevates herself above him, where he kind of falls down because as during the last rites before they set fire to the place, the priest was referred to him as playing the role of the Dark One, the opposite from the what? Go ahead.
No, we understand that, but if she wasn't a damaged human being, she wouldn't have chose him, and she would have chose the other person, and. And, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, there was no way he could, and it was no way any of them could be quote unquote gods except for her, because she's the only one that was participating. And maybe the British girl, had she not been killed already, would have participated. Those were the only two. Only two females would have had a chance to become the quote unquote May Queen or goddess, as you want to call it, Abe. So, I don't think it really matters that she stepped ahead of him, because that's just
It actually does in terms of the way the characters develop.
No, but I understand all that. But again, though, there was no chance that anybody, whether it's Josh, Matt, Christian, or the British guy, were ever going to become higher than the head of the May Queen. No one can be higher than the May Queen, except maybe the elder that's running it, you know? So I see your point, Abe, but I don't think it's really that consequential, except for the fact that she's dominant now over him because she makes the choice to have him killed.
Should have broke up with her a long time ago.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dude. I would have been out of that relationship way back because, there's way too many happy and fun people in the world. Why would anybody date crazy?
Well, there's that scene early in the bar where he's talking about what if I regret doing it and stuff like that. He's one of the things Stiles is not – only is he a dick a lot of times, he's also extremely indecisive.
Well, that's the problem, is that he's damaged goods himself.
Yeah, mm-hmm. And a very different story of the way. He's a late bloomer. He hasn't completely found himself. He can't make real decisions of his own. He has problems with commitments and stuff like that, because sometimes it's just...
Right.
You know, a lot of, like, fear of what-ifs.
Right, right. If he was a little more mature, he would have got out of that relationship a long time ago. Because
or maybe giving her the support she needed to get some help or do what she not be completely left adrift and getting shitty advice from a shitty boyfriend.
Right. And again, I mean, I'll say that he's a shitty boyfriend because that wasn't his relationship, not because he's an evil person by any means.
I said evil.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go with.
I say he was a dick.
I'm pretty sure
he used the phrase evil.
I'm going to go with Jamie as the guest host of Cut to the Chase, which said that he wasn't a bad guy at all. He just shouldn't have been in that relationship.
He was immature. He was a dude, bro.
I think he's a bad guy, and he shouldn't have been in that relationship.
when I say evil, I say it's a more benign sort of evil compared to how a lot of these boyfriend characters are usually portrayed, where they're thrown into an extreme sort of personality versus something a little more grounded.
Well, right, but this wasn't a caricature. This was a person that...
That's what I'm saying.
As Phil likes to say, this guy was a dink.
Yeah, but only because he was in a relationship with her. If he was not in that relationship, he's also a dink in other ways.
No, because if he wasn't in a relationship with her, he still would have done this stupid thesis thing. Yeah, he's still immature and indecisive.
Yeah, that's a fair point. The thesis thing was kind of, but wasn't really that dinkish. I mean, it wasn't
guys.
Well, it totally deserved to be burned alive.
Well, this is the thing. Let's talk about that thesis thing. When he says, yeah, Josh, I just want to let you know that I think I'm going to write about this cult too. And you could argue that Josh was a dink instead, and it wasn't him that was dink, because Josh could have said, "Yeah, all right, that sounds cool, man. We'll, but he didn't.
That would be a lame argument, but you could make it.
Well, but Josh immediately says, "You're stealing my idea, you son of a bitch." And it's like,
well, and that's a completely justified reaction.
But it also
he had all the intention of doing it before they even got there.
Right, but he also could have said, "Oh yeah, that's cool, man."
But it's not cool.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how these thesis things work. What? I don't see anything funny. I'm just saying.
Having two people with the same thesis at the same school would be problematic.
Yes, because in the very fact he's stealing an idea. He's stealing a project because he's too lazy to come up with his own. He knew well beforehand we got there, as Eric and Mike said, before they even arrived there, he knew that this what he wanted to that he knew that Josh wanted to write the paper on this, and he's just
Well, I don't know how theses are. Right, I didn't know that everybody has to choose a different thesis. This is new to me because
these aren't like book reports in high school. Everybody needs
an original idea. Yeah.
Well, not where I went. You could have people that did the same idea. In other words, when we did book reports, someone could have read the same book and did a
report. But that's what I said. It's not a book report.
Right. It's not. Yeah, I don't know how thesis work. I don't.
That's fine.
It's fine.
Okay. It's what it is. It's a thesis to get your PhD. So when you're getting your PhD, it's expected not only that you do a thesis, but it has to be like original research and like something nobody's ever done before. And it's like a very big stressful thing. And so that's what makes it even worse that this guy is like, oh, I'm just going to copy yours. Because that he would get maybe not thrown out of school, but he wouldn't really be able to float that, I don't think, in the real world.
No, and it's just another thing. It just kind of shows another aspect of Christian that is just his laziness.
Well, Josh does say to him that I've already reported what I was going to do my thesis on.
Mm-hmm.
While you haven't, so they're going to take mine over yours. And then Josh said something like, yeah, but not this specific cult or commune. And so Josh is I guess you're right. So Josh is clueless where he thinks that he could do the same type of thesis on a commune as well. Even if it's different communes, it's still the same principle, right? The same topic, I guess.
All right.
I think we're getting in the weeds here.
Yeah,
we're kind of off track at this point. I think we're kind of dilly-dallying here and there now.
Let's wrap this up, shall we?
Yeah, all right. That's fine. All right, so let's see. Before we get our final thoughts, Eric, you have to do another podcast with your buddy Dan?
I do. It's a general interest podcast called the Askancity Podcast. That's spelled A-S-K-A-N-C-I-T-Y. You can find it on Google Play, Stitcher, iTunes, and I'm forgetting one. Spotify, that's the other one. Spotify.
And Overcast.
And Overcast, yes.
And probably
a bunch of other places.
Yeah, that's right. Mike, we do a couple other podcasts, and we're coming up with a new one, me, Eric, and you.
The new one is eventually a year in the making, I think. Cinema a la Carte, which is going to be looking at non-Dark Discussions related films on an irregular basis, apparently very, very irregular at this point. Then, of course, we will be having sometime in 2020 the return of Bullets, Bobbles, and Bots, a Westworld podcast, and perhaps Searching for American Gods about the Star TV series American Gods. And you can go look through our archives for You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, a Game of Thrones podcast.
Very good. And Chrissy, you have a book signing coming up?
I do. My short story collection is called The Shadows Behind. I have a book signing coming up at Howe Caverns on Saturday, August 3rd. Howe Caverns is located in Howe's Cave, New York. It is in Schoharie County. You can just Google it. Or visit my website and learn more about me at ChristyPetersonSchoonover.com and come on up and see me at Howe Caverns.
Excellent. Very good. Very good. All right.
We also have a couple of different recordings coming up and down the line. Stay tuned for our second book review with me and Phil and some guest hosts for Salem's Lot.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So Salem's Lot, we're going to do the book on that. Basically do a new book every quarter, I think, right?
Pretty much. Give some time for everybody to read it, because some people haven't got a chance, or they want to revisit the text.
Right, exactly. Speaking of text, Eric, I finished The Outsider, which was recommended by you.
Uh-huh.
It's a Stephen King book, and it's pretty right on with what Mike and Chrissy always say, which is King is awesome, but his endings always have some problems.
usually.
Yeah. But it was still a pretty damn good book, all in all.
I enjoyed it.
It was, I think it was really, really fantastic, even if there were some issues at the end. So I just finished that one. And I may read his Sleeping Beauty, the one that he wrote with his son, Owen Hill.
I haven't caught up on that one.
Yeah, me neither. I have it sent on my books. I just haven't done it yet. But yeah. So that's good. The Outsider was a pretty good book. And some of the characters in that were in that Mr. Mercedes trilogy that you were telling me about. Mm-hmm. So I may start checking out those books too. But I do hate characters when they appear in more than one book, because a lot of them just have plot armor and it's not as fun. I like going in with brand new characters and leaving with those characters. And
I actually preferred The Outsiders to the Mr. Mercedes trilogy.
Yeah, that's just what you told me. Yeah,
it's a trilogy. I knew there was two books. I didn't realize there was a third.
Yeah.
I'm guessing they're going to use that for the.
Yeah, I think for the third season.
Yeah.
And then I think it's done. I think that's what they were going to do. It was only going to be three seasons, but I don't know. And that's on Hulu, right, Mike? The Mr. Mercedes.
I have no idea. Wasn't when I was watching it. I don't know where it is now.
Yeah, I don't know where it is.
Was it anyway. The Audience or Applause Network, something like that?
Oh, yeah, that's right. It was one of those weird networks. All right, so I guess we give our final thoughts on this movie here. So let's start with you, Eric.
Okay, this was a really visually interesting movie. Ari Aster is clearly a talented individual. I'm still trying to figure out if I actually like this movie or not, but there's certainly a lot to think about. So I guess I would recommend it.
All right. Very good. Let's go with you, Abe.
This movie is pretty well made. It's well shot. It has some really weird and freaky visuals. For me, it's kind of up and down, though. I thought some moments were stronger than others. I thought there are moments where the pacing kind of dragged and felt a little bloated. But there were moments where it kept me really engaged. It didn't work for me completely, but there was enough there that it was really interesting. I would definitely say if you want to check it out, go see it in the theater as soon as you can. If not, you can wait and for the DVD release, because it sounds like we'll have some extra footage coming our way, and maybe you watch it then. I don't think it's going to be for everybody, but. If you enjoyed Hereditary, you might enjoy this.
Yep, that's right. For me, I know there's some issues with this film, as there is with most films anyway. But again, they're mostly nitpicks and whatnot, and you know, you go with the flow. And in my opinion, Midsommar is so far the best genre film of 2019, and it is at this time probably my favorite horror film of the year. Though again, I still have to go back to review what I've seen, but either way, it's definitely in the top five for sure, and it would not surprise me if it stays close to the top by the end of the year, even with some hidden gems and bigger films coming out. I would highly recommend the film. As people said, it's definitely not for everybody. I think I would be okay calling it an art house film, because it's definitely the type of film that would be playing at my local art house theater. So if you're not into that type of film, it may not be for you. It, as Abe said, it's very long, and not much really happens until the end. There's shocking scenes here and there, and there's a lot of dread and uncomfortableness going on throughout the film. However, it's you know, 2 hours and whatever, 40-minute, you know, slow film. But it's an excellent film, and I would recommend it. Mike, let's go with you, I guess.
Yeah, it's I think this is one of the stronger films in what has so far shaped up to be a not terribly strong year. I didn't like this nearly as much as I liked Hereditary. It is slow. It is methodical. It is also somewhat predictable, but I did think it is very well shot. I think it is very well performed. It's a beautiful film to watch. It's got a lot of interesting things going on in it, even if none of it's necessarily surprising things. This is not necessarily one I will automatically pick up when it comes out. I'm going to hear the reviews of the extra 30 minutes to see if they really add much to it. But I certainly, if you're a horror fan listening to this podcast, there's no reason not to check it out unless you absolutely hate art house horror.
All right, very good. Crazy.
I'm with Eric. I really haven't decided if I actually like this film or not. I think it's incredibly emotionally disturbing. I think it's powerful. I think it's an excellent definition of horror, really. But it's very intense. And I know we keep saying this film is not going to be for everybody, but it's not going to be for everybody. I think it's a pretty solid film. Just be prepared that it is extremely graphic, which we didn't really expound upon tonight. So if you are sensitive to that, definitely stay away. Other than that, I would say yes, give it a shot. It is not one that you need to spend money on in the movies, though. If you are kind of on the fence, wait and check it out on Netflix or something, or, you know, rent it when you're in the comfort of your own home. But yeah, I mean, I don't know what I'm going to do, if I'm going to pick it up or not. But I mean, I liked it. I just don't know if I love it. So anyway.
All right. Very good. So that's 2019's Midsommar, the sophomore effort of Ari Aster. It's getting fairly decent reviews, around 82% on Rotten Tomatoes. Most people that have talked about it, though, I've been avoiding it as much as possible, said they pretty much thought it was pretty good, though there's been a lot of folks, such as Jessica Herrera and others, who've said this is one of the worst films they've seen this year. So it's a very divisive film. So again, as Mike said, depending on art house and whatnot, but Chrissy does make an excellent point, which is, has a lot of dread going on, and that alone makes it, quote-unquote, a horror film that is fairly effective. Check it out at the theater now, because it's going to be gone soon. It's already down to the bottom of the top 10. Otherwise, as Abe said, catch it when it comes out on VOD or disc, because it'll be available probably everywhere through VOD, and the disc will also have an extended cut of the film, which could be quite interesting. And if Eric is right, maybe we'll be lucky and get a bunch of extras, including a director's commentary. So with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us talk about Midsommar. Come back next week. We'll have another topic.